not deny that modern doubt, like ancient doubt, asks deep questions. I only deny that it gives any deeper answers. I will even concede that the questions produced by what is called modern thought are often quite deep. But I must conclude that the answers are often decidedly shallow. And perhaps it is even more important to remark that while the questions are in a sense eternal, the answers are in every sense ephemeral.
In his classic book, Orthodoxy, Chesterton wrote, "Thinking means connecting things." And that is exactly what he does in this collection of essays called The Well and the Shallows. Hello, I'm Dale Alquist, and welcome to The Apostle of Common Sense, a series of programs where we explore the words and wisdom of the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. In The Well and the Shallows, Chesterton makes startling connections between things, between capitalism and sex, between Protestantism and fossils, between skepticism and soap, between commercialism and rotten apples. This book, which was published in 1935, could also be called More of the Thing, because once again, Chesterton connects the thing to everything else. The thing is the Catholic faith, which is not merely a religious doctrine, but a complete and integrated view of the world. Chesterton argues that all other religious, political, and social ideas are not only enemies of the church, but enemies of mankind. He shows how the Catholic faith not only provides the basis for our worship, but for everything else. Nothing else provides the deep answers for the deep questions. The Catholic Church is the well, everything else is the shallows. In the book, Chesterton gives a number of reasons why, after considering several other religions, philosophies, and political theories, and discovering how flimsy and fleeting they are, he would have converted to Catholicism, except for one problem. He already had. All other systems, at some point and in some way, attack the idea of free will. And when they attack free will, they attack human dignity. One of the reasons for Chesterton's greatness is that he always defends freedom and dignity. He argues that nothing is inevitable. We need never to surrender to this or that set of circumstances, to social forces, to biological determinism, to history, or to fate. This is the essence of freedom. Modern man thinks freedom means breaking the rules. But as Chesterton points out, freedom means exercising free will to obey the rules. Without freedom, there's no such thing as obedience and responsibility. We're not forced to obey. We choose. That is what gives us our dignity. We make a vow by choice. Freedom means keeping the vow, no matter how difficult, not breaking it, no matter how compelling. The world, of course, thinks that a person who becomes Catholic gives up his liberty. But as Chesterton says, tell a Catholic convert that he's lost his liberty, and he will laugh. This book is largely a defense of liberty and an attack on its enemies. The progressives, the reactionaries, the socialists, the capitalists, all appeal to trends and inevitabilities. Some insist that the world is getting better, others insist that the world's getting worse. But Chesterton says, what the world does is wobble. Life itself is not a ladder, it is a seesaw. This is basically what the church has always said. There are wrongs that can be righted and should be righted, but there's no certainty that they will be righted.
The church tells us that we must not count on the certainty of comforts becoming more common or cruelties more rare, as if there was an inevitable trend toward a perfect and perfectly sinless humanity. We must not hate humanity or despise humanity or refuse to help humanity, but we must not trust humanity.
When Chesterton says we must not trust humanity, he especially reminds us not to put too much trust in politics or in whatever political party we pick. We generally expect too much from political parties, but none of them are based on any permanent philosophy, and because of that, at some point, they will conflict with the faith. A Catholic would be especially wise not to put too much faith in anything other than the faith. A Catholic should resist the fleeting philosophies and the ephemeral ideas offered by any social movement or political party or anything else. Certainly, we should be wise enough not to put our trust in progress. Progress cannot say what it is. It is detached from any eternal goals. It is purely pragmatic and ultimately immoral. And Chesterton predicts in this book, written in 1935, that the march of progress will lead us through contraception to abortion and to infanticide. He also seems to be describing the present state of things when he says, one of the chief natures of the state of peace which we now enjoy is the killing of a considerable number of harmless human beings. There are many other prophetic comments in this book. He anticipates the trend of our popular entertainment to the ever bigger, bolder, louder, and more shocking. He says, the nerve is being killed, and it is being killed by being overstimulated and therefore stunted and stunned. He also rightly predicts that people would appeal to conscience as the supreme authority and use it to justify every ill-conceived idea. And he argues, why should your conscience be any more reliable than your rotting teeth or your defective eyesight? A Catholic appeals to something much higher and more trustworthy than conscience. A Catholic, says Chesterton, is a person who has plucked up the courage to face the incredible and inconceivable idea that something else may be wiser than he is. The Church proclaims the truth. Those who reject the Church would like truth to conform to their own desires. They will not admit the truth, which is something greater than themselves. They will not only disobey the truth, they will attack it.
What is really at work in the world today is anti-Catholicism and nothing else. It certainly is not Protestantism. You see, Protestantism is now only a name. But it is a name that can be used to cover virtually every ism, except Catholicism. It is now a receptacle into which can be poured all the thousand things that for a thousand reasons react against Rome. But it can only be full of these things because it is itself empty. Every sort of negation, every sort of new religion, every sort of moral revolt or intellectual irritation that can make a man resist the claim of the Catholic faith is here gathered into a heap and covered with a convenient label. What is replacing this hallow thing called Protestantism is paganism, which is a thing more attractive because it appears to be more human than any of the heresies. The pagan looks to the natural forces of this world for his pleasures. But these natural forces, when they are turned into gods, betray mankind by something that is in the very nature of nature worship. We can already see men becoming unhealthy by the worship of health, becoming hateful by the worship of love, becoming paradoxically solemn and overstrained by the idolatry of sport, and in some cases, strangely morbid and infected with horrors by the perversion of a just sympathy with animals. And why? Because there is nothing in paganism to check its own exaggerations. And what can check it? Only a return to Thomistic philosophy can check it, because it is the philosophy of common sense. In this sense, the Roman religion will be the only rationalistic religion. After the materialist, who says that the soul does not exist, and the mystic who says that the body does not exist, there will be the return of the scholastic and the rational, sane notion that both exist. To say that there is no pain or no matter or no evil or no difference between man and beast or indeed between anything and anything else, this is all a desperate effort to destroy all experience and sense of reality. Those who leave the tradition of truth do not escape into something called freedom. They only escape into something which we call fashion. Most of them are atheists, but they call themselves secularists. The word secular, however, does not mean anything so sensible as worldly, or anything so spirited as irreligious. It simply means to be of the age. That is, the age which is passing, or of the age which, in their case, has already passed. The only equivalent, the only really adequate equivalent of the word secular is the word dated.
Chesterton also rightly predicts that the moderns would rebel against modernism. When progressives come to the edge of the precipice, it is only the people behind them who are still shouting, "Forward!" The modern mind, he says, is not at all accustomed to making up its mind. And modern intellectuals, for want of a more intellectual term, says Chesterton, while unable to make up their own minds, would like to make up everyone else's mind. On the one hand, they'd like to force social programs on common people that would deprive them of their freedom. On the other hand, they'd like to do away with the basic moral truths, calling the resulting anarchy freedom, and thereby deprive people of their dignity.
There are not many things which move me to personal contempt. For instance, I do not feel contempt for an atheist, who is often a man limited by his own logic to a very sad simplification. Nor do I feel any contempt for a communist, who is often a man driven to the same negative simplification by a desire to revolt against very positive wrongs. But I do feel what I can only call contempt for the popular propagandist of what is absurdly called birth control. I despise birth control, first because it is a weak and wobbly and cowardly word. It is also an entirely meaningless word. What its quack doctors, who are really not doctors at all, but propagandists, what they recommend does not control any birth. It only tries to make sure that there will never be any birth to control. But of course, these people know that they dare not write the plain word birth prevention. So they instead write the hypocritical word birth control. Secondly, I despise birth control because it is a weak and wobbly and cowardly thing. It is, of course, you see, a scheme for preventing birth in order to escape control. But my contempt boils over into bad behavior when I hear that people want to avoid a birth because they want to be free to go to the cinema or buy a gramophone. How dare they use the word free? By every act of birth prevention, they chain themselves to the most servile and mechanical system yet tolerated by man. What are the cinema and the gramophone but central mechanisms giving men exactly what their masters want them to have? But a child is the very sign and sacrament of personal freedom. His is a fresh free will added to the free wills of the world. He is something that his parents have freely chosen to produce and freely agree to protect. He has been born without the intervention of any master or lord. He is a creation and a contribution. People who prefer mechanical pleasures to such a miracle are jaded. Worse than that, they are enslaved. They are preferring the very dregs of life to the first fountains of life. It is they who are hugging the chains of their old slavery, while it is the child who is ready for the new world.
Chesterton says that the modern sin of sex differs from the ancient sin of sex, and the ancient sin of sex actually wasn't as bad because it was at least tied in with the cult of fruitfulness. It was at least on the side of nature and on the side of life. But the moderns have invented a new kind of worship, a worship of sex, and one which is not even a worship of life. It is one which at once exalts lust and forbids fertility. And just as sex has been separated from fertility and become perverted, Chesterton says there's been a similar separation and perversion about the nature of property.
When modern men think of property, they only think of it in the sense of money, in the sense of salary, meaning something which is immediately consumed, enjoyed, and expended, something which gives momentary pleasure and disappears. They do not understand that we mean by property something that includes that pleasure incidentally, but begins and ends with something far more grand and worthy and creative. The man who grows and owns an orchard surely enjoys the taste of apples, and let us hope also the taste of cider. But he is doing something very much grander and ultimately more gratifying than merely eating an apple. He is asserting that his soul is his own and does not belong to the orchard survey department or the chief trust in the apple trade. But he is also worshipping the fruitfulness of the world. Now the notion of narrowing property merely to enjoying money is exactly like the notion of narrowing love merely to enjoying sex. In both cases, an incidental, isolated, servile, and even secretive pleasure is substituted for participation in a great creative process, even in the everlasting creation of the world.
Whether we are talking about the fruitfulness of orchards or of people, Chesterton says, the real habitation of liberty is the home. Everything in the modern world, our entertainment, our literature, our newspapers, tries to cover up this truth. The real habitation of liberty is the home. He says if individuals have any hope of protecting their freedom, they must protect their family life. That is why Chesterton defends widespread property ownership, the idea that each family has a place to call its own, a place to protect itself. Here, as elsewhere, he shows how the two great enemies of property and of the family are big government and big business.
The government did not have such power over us when it could send men to the stake, as it does now when it can send them to the elementary school.
But surprisingly, Chesterton says, what has done more to destroy the family in the modern world, even before the state got in on the act, is capitalism. It is capitalism that has taken the women out of the home and put them into commercial competition with men. It is capitalism that has destroyed the influence of the parent in favor of the employer. And it is capitalism that has driven people off the land and into the cities, making them more attached to their factories and their firms rather than their families. The problem, he says, is that trade has replaced truth. Trade, which is in its nature a secondary or dependent thing, has been elevated to a primary and independent thing, as an absolute. We're no longer concerned about the good, but about the goods.
In all normal civilizations, the trader existed and must exist. But in all normal civilizations, the trader was the exception. Certainly, he was never the rule. And most certainly, he was never the ruler. The predominance which he has gained in the modern world is the cause of all the disasters of the modern world. The universal habit of humanity has been to produce and consume as part of the same process, largely conducted by the same people, and in the same place. For most of the time, people were thinking about growing food, and then eating it. Not entirely about growing food and selling it at the stiffest price, but to somebody who had nothing to eat.
Chesterton says there's no way out of the modern tangle except for independent people and independent families to live simpler lives. That means learning how to be content with less, so that we can be more content. To be content is to be free. We're now caught up in a system that is designed to keep us discontented and unsatisfied. A society that is commercial and nothing else is not a society based on contentment. It's not solid. Chesterton says, nothing solid can be built on the utterly unphilosophical philosophy of blind buying and selling, bullying people into purchasing what they do not want, of making it so badly that they may break it and imagine they want it again, of keeping rubbish in rapid circulation like a dust storm in a desert, and pretending that that is teaching men to hope. Capitalism is as materialistic a philosophy as communism, and can never provide the basis for human happiness, nor can any other system, except one. In one of the most remarkable observations in the book, Chesterton says, "There are no fascists, there are no socialists, there are no liberals, there are no parliamentarians. In the place of all of them, there is only the church, the one supremely inspiring and irritating institution in the world. There's only the church and its enemies. And its enemies are ready to be for or against violence, for or against liberty, for or against representative government, even for or against peace." He says that all the things that have come forward to try to take the place of the church, to do its work, have instead tied themselves into knots and cannot do anything. The heresies decay and destroy themselves. Anything less than the Catholic faith is narrow and shallow and barren. Chesterton reminds us that we've come out of the shallows and the dry places to the one deep well, and the truth is at the bottom of it. I'm Dale Alquist. Join us again for the Apostle of Common Sense.